Drizzle rolling through the area right now. 52 degrees in Racine, 51 this morning in Kenosha, 49 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. WGTD News Time, 8:10. Morning Show with Greg Berg, up next. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from Carthage College, Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available online at carthage.edu/grad.
It's not all that often that we find the worlds of business and strategic planning in the sphere of business intersecting with what we think of as the more creative sphere of the performing arts. But in a sense, that is what happens with our guest on this portion of the morning show, Bob Caparoli, who is the president of Sequent Learning Network, which is an advisory firm for the business sector. But he also happens to be an accomplished musician, an accomplished keyboardist, an accomplished composer. And in a sense, he has combined both of his perspectives together in a strategy which he shares in a new book called Creative Strategy Generation, Using Passion and Creativity to Compose Business Strategies that Inspire Action and Growth, published by McGraw-Hill Education. So in this book, Bob Caparoli is encouraging people in business to approach the matter of strategic planning maybe with a bit more of creative flair than one might think of, where you feel maybe tied to pie charts and graphs that are all about numbers. He is suggesting that there are other exciting possibilities that really need to be a part of the creation of strategic planning. And in fact, he uses the verb composing strategic plans very deliberately, for he believes that much as a musician might compose a piece of music or an artist might compose a painting, so a strategic plan should be composed with a similar emphasis on the creative process. So we have him on the phone to talk for the next minute, a few minutes, about his book, again called Creative Strategy Generation. Bob Caparoli, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. So tell our listeners, or explain this sort of dual identity which you have, the fact that the work that you do, the way you pay the rent, is in working in this as president of this advising firm for the world of business, and yet someone who is also a good musician with intense interest in music and obviously a passion for it as well. How have these two things coexisted in your life up until now?
Well, up until now, they've really kind of coexisted a bit separately, or at least I thought. You know, I've always used music as a creative outlet, continued to do it as a hobby. Of course, I would have loved to do it full-time coming right out of high school and college, but, you know, went into a business career like I think many other musicians end up doing, and really enjoyed that as well. So I kind of kept the two worlds a bit separate. But as I went on in my business career and had more success in that area, I started to realize that a lot of what I was doing on the music side, you know, composing original songs and that type of thing, I really carried over a lot of those same skills into my business career, and allowed me to be creative, allowed me to come up with new ideas and execute on those new ideas. And as I started to really see those correlations more and more, I really wanted to capture it, and that's how the book came about.
Hmm. And I suppose it must be kind of intriguing to think about melding those two worlds and melding those two approaches and maybe melding two different worlds of lingo. I mean, you're bringing some things together that are often not brought together.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And you know, as I went through my business career, I almost thought it was taboo, you know, not that anybody would care that I was a musician or anything like that, but to think about bringing that world into the business world was something that, you know, you just don't normally see in a boardroom. But in fact, it's what most companies want, right? They want creativity from their people. They want innovative new products. And those things are accomplished by applying the same principles that you would for the creative arts. And so, you know, although I didn't formally bring it into my business world early in my career, as I began to do it more and advertise it more, it really started to resonate. Hmm.
So for you to sit down and write this book, I think must suggest at least an assumption on your part that there are a whole lot of people going about this, in a sense, the wrong way or in a deficient way when they are putting together their own strategic plans for their own businesses. Let's begin with, in a sense, the need, what you see as the need for this kind of refreshing new approach. What's wrong with creating strategic plans in the way that it has maybe typically been done, much more kind of number generated and just the facts kind of approach? What do you see as the greatest problems or deficiencies in that kind of standard approach?
So there's really two major deficiencies that I see quite commonly, and I should mention that the job that I have today, you know, I run a company called Secret Learning Network, so spend most of my days in large and medium-sized companies and corporations helping people with this very subject. So I do have quite a view into the way that many companies are doing it today. And I think the two problems that I see most often is, number one, the way that people get taught about strategy and business strategy in school is by and large by looking at the way other companies have done it or other people have done it. And that's a good learning tool because you can see kind of the pros and cons of somebody else's approach. But when you try and turn that into a framework and say, well, I'm going to do, you know, create my strategy the exact same way, or you think that you should, then you lose that creative flair and you can't ever really repeat what somebody else did. So there's a built-in deficiency to that methodology. The second piece is what you very rightly said. I think there's a lot of focus on the backup information, the data. And the data, again, is an important part of any process. But when you overly rely upon it, or you just think that a strategic presentation is all about the numbers and the charts and the homework, and you kind of remove that unique flair from it, then again, you're doing yourself a disservice. And I see a lot of businesses do that. Their strategic presentations, especially at a product line and a market level, they end up becoming a conglomeration of charts and data without a whole lot of thought to, well, what are you going to do with that? And what are you going to do differently? And that's really what I'm trying to instill in people.
We're speaking with Bob Caparoli about his book, Creative Strategy Generation, Using Passion and Creativity to Compose Business Strategies that Inspire Action and Growth. You set out a couple of sort of frameworks for us to sort of think about this, including something that's probably very important for us to touch on, namely what you see as the seven steps in ultimately creating what would be a successful strategic plan. And it's interesting how at least some of these steps harken back to the world of music. But it begins with preparation and it ends with the production, as though we were maybe putting together some sort of Broadway musical or something for presentation to a public. Take our listeners through these seven steps.
Sure. So there are seven steps, and it almost sounds cliche. I almost hoped that it wasn't going to end up at seven because it seems like everyone has a seven-step process, but it actually ends up being seven steps. The seven steps that I outline really are around, you can correlate them to strategy, but really it's around a creative process. So what are the seven steps to any creative process? And, of course, what I've applied it to here in the book is strategy. So the first step is preparation, and it's really about that's where the data and the charts and those kinds of things come in. You have to have a foundation of knowledge from which new ideas will be generated, and so that first step is about building that foundation of knowledge. The second step is inspiration, and inspiration is really all about understanding what it is that you want to do, but not just from the standpoint of inside you, but also how you want to connect to somebody else. So in business, it's really important that you don't just think about what motivates you as a company, you know, I want to make more money or this or that. It really is about what inspires you from the standpoint of wanting to help a customer, or what do you want to do for your target market? And again, the same thing would happen in music or the arts. The third step is about genre. So genre, we sometimes think of as a style, but I think about genre as a preference. So again, understanding who you want to connect with and what those needs are of the people that you want to connect with is the third step. The fourth is ideation, and ideation now will come from those first three steps. Once you have done those things, then ideas start to flow. Then you have to arrange those ideas into a way that you can connect them to other people, and that's what the fifth step is arrangement. Sixth step is orchestration, bringing other people into that arrangement, collaborating so that you could actually build the final piece, which you do in the seventh step, which is production, and that's actually producing a final work of art, executing on that work of art, and connecting with the people that you intended to connect with. So that's the seven steps in a nutshell, whether it's strategy, creative arts, music, anything else, those same seven steps can be applied.
How would you say that these seven steps most dramatically differ from the more typical way that a strategic plan is put together? Are there some of these steps that typically are missing altogether or are neglected in more typical frameworks, or is the order a bit different? What would you say sets this apart most dramatically from, in a sense, more pedestrian or ordinary ways of the same pursuit?
So I think the best way to answer that is that, you know, existing strategic frameworks tend to focus on maybe the foundational information, the preparation part. What is the knowledge that you have to have in order to build the strategy? And then some of them also, of course, go into the ideation part, which is, you know, the need to have great new ideas. But I think very few frameworks actually kind of step people through how do you go about taking that foundational knowledge and turning it into an idea. And again, it's a hard subject to teach, but what these seven steps will allow you to do is to take that foundational knowledge and then apply more information that will automatically lead to those ideas. I think the second part that existing frameworks tend to not cover as well is, okay, once you have these ideas, how do you arrange them in a way that connect emotionally with other people, whether that's people within your own company that you need to communicate the strategy to, or your customers, most importantly, that you have to execute the strategy with respect to. And so that's where the real creative process comes into play. It's not just about having the ideas. It's about arranging them and connecting them in a way that allows that strategy to come to life. So that's what I really tried to cover here that I think existing processes don't necessarily cover as thoroughly.
I especially appreciated in the book a moment when you talk about the importance of developing what you call the aria. That is four proficiencies that are essential for this process to be fully successful, namely analysis, recollection, intuition, and artistry. And at least a couple of those terms, I think, very seldom are referred to when people are talking about something like developing a strategic plan for a business. Talk us through these four proficiencies that you see as so essential to all this.
Yeah, so you know, a lot of people want to jump right into the process and, you know, what are the steps and then go through the steps, and it's extremely important. But I dedicate a whole chapter to saying, you know, before you just jump right into a step-by-step process, what you really want to do is make sure that you have the skills that allow you and enable you to get the most out of the process. And I call these proficiencies because skills implies that you have to have some level of skill. Proficiency says that you know, have to master these skills to some extent. And the four skills of analysis, recollection, intuition, and artistry really are meant to correspond to the four questions that have been asked throughout the centuries with respect to strategies, which is, where are we now? Where have we been? Where are we going? And how are we going to get there? So analysis covers where are we now, recollection, where have we been, intuition, where are we going, and artistry, how are we going to get there, and more specifically in a unique way. And so the idea is build these skills and you'll be able to answer those questions so that when you go into the process, now you're fully equipped to actually get the most out of it.
Hmm. Certainly one of the terms to which you turn again and again, and I don't think it's too much of a surprise actually, is the importance of storytelling. Although, again, that's not a term that probably shows up all that often in other books or other presentations about the creation of strategic planning. But, of course, when you really stop and think about it, storytelling is so much at the heart of a lot of things that we do. Just say a word about the crucial role of storytelling and maybe some words of advice for someone who might be sort of uncomfortable with the notion of making use of something as personal as storytelling in the creation of a strategic plan.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things about storytelling is it's really just a way to connect your ideas to other people. And it happens all the time. You know, if we think about watching a movie, if there's not a story for us to grab onto, we're not going to listen to any of the messages. And it's the same thing when you're presenting something to somebody else. It's becoming quite popular in business circles nowadays, but specifically with respect to the strategic planning process, once you have all these great ideas, you've arranged them in such a way that that you want to connect them. Now you have to really connect them to other people, whether that's people in your own company who need to execute that strategy or your customers. You know, they need to know what message you're trying to send them. And so I dedicate a lot of time to saying, okay, take those ideas and arrange them in a way that will allow you to tell a story and connect that story to other people so they'll feel what you're feeling and will be able to execute on the strategy the way that you want them to. So it's a really, really important element. And if you don't do it, you know, you'll have all the ideas in your head, but you'll never be able to get them out into the world.
Right. Well, I think you've really done a great service to a whole lot of people who find themselves maybe sort of stuck in the midst of this kind of a process. And I also appreciate, being a musician myself and someone who appreciates the arts, how refreshing it is to hear terminology and principles that really spring from the performing arts brought into this particular arena. It's just something that doesn't happen very often. By and large, as you do your advising work and consultant work, do you find people to be immediately and easily accessible or open to these ideas?
You know, more so than I ever expected, to be honest with you. Again, you know, the advising and consulting work, I've started to slowly incorporate these direct references into the teachings and trainings and so forth. And that I'm doing them now more directly with the release of the book and so forth, the response has just been phenomenal. I mean, people really love connecting this business world to something that they can relate to on a personal level and that they enjoy on a personal level, whether they're musicians or not. Almost everybody loves some type of music. And so having these references just makes the process so much more fun. And I find people just open their minds up to this world that they maybe thought was a little bit more academic and not as interesting to them, and now all of a sudden they find this passion in it, and it's just been so great to experience.
The book again is Creative Strategy Generation: Using Passion and Creativity to Compose Business Strategies That Inspire Action and Growth, published by McGraw-Hill Education, the author Bob Caporali. Thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show and for talking about your interesting ideas and this very interesting book.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
Part two of The Morning Show is coming up in just a moment here on WGTD. And now I'm pleased to say that for part two of today's morning show here on WGTD, we are welcoming back into our studios Dr. James Kinchin, the Director of Choral Activities at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, right up the road from us. And Dr. Kinchin, of course, has joined us on any number of occasions to talk about the many interesting and outstanding choral music events which occur at Parkside on quite a regular basis. On this particular occasion, we are talking about an extraordinary trip which Dr. Kinchin undertook with the students in his Voices of Parkside group, a trip which took them, in of all places, to India. Not exactly the first place we think of when we think of great choral music, but of course it's an important nation on earth, a place we all need to know more about. And from the sounds of it, it was an incredible trip, exciting and moving and inspiring in a lot of different ways. So I'm really happy that Dr. Kinchin can join me for this portion of the morning show to talk about this adventure to India. Dr. James Kinchin, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg. Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be back.
Good to be having you here. I think it wasn't terribly long ago, if correct me if I'm wrong, that we talked about a trip which you made to Cuba.
Yes, yes.
And was that also with one of your choirs from Parkside, or was that a trip you did on your own?
No, it was a trip I did on my own, and actually I have been now three times to Cuba. The first time I went with a sort of loosely constructed choral group, partially under the aegis of the Friendship Force, and that happened to have been in 1999, and then I returned a couple of times after that on the invitation of a community-based choral group in Cuba called the Shalom Choir that had me come back and do some clinic work with them. And by the way, I'm expecting to go to Cuba again in January.
Wow. And again, a place we don't immediately think of as a hotbed of choral music activity, and that just shows how out of it we are, that we just assume that for some reason Cuba is not going to be a place where choral music would be important.
Yeah, they have fine choirs there, and there are at least, and I don't say this to exclude anybody that I don't mention, but there are at least a couple of choirs there, the National Choir of Cuba and Exaudi, who are actually world-class choirs. I mean, they're up there with the very best from anywhere.
Wow. So you have been there, and now, as we said at the top of the program, you have also now just recently been to India, which also is one of those choices that might surprise us a bit. I assume that you didn't just sort of arbitrarily choose India out of all the places you could have conceivably visited on the globe. I suspect this springs from some kind of connection of one kind or another.
Yeah. Well, you know, it springs. That's a really good word, a good descriptor. It springs from a seed, as many good things do, that has its origins with a gentleman, a colleague of mine, who's a professor in the business school, but is also special assistant to the Chancellor for International Relations. His name is Abby Karivala. And he saw very early on that there was this potential. Now, what to give you some larger context for what he does, he is the person who's usually in the forefront of helping to create international connections and relationships, even collaborations and articulations between our university and others. And so we have now relationships with universities in a number of different places, including Italy and Germany and Russia and so forth and so on. He saw this potential, and he thought that it was particularly fruitful for a connection through our music program, which up to this point has not had any particular role in any of those international connections. And so, you know, the seed was planted with him. There was planned at Mahatma Gandhi University a conference, a seminar on the science of music. And so he made them aware of us and our program and our work and me particularly, and immediately they were interested. And so back in the spring, he put out a feeler to me. He said he wanted to come and sit and chat to see if I would be open to accepting an invitation to present to be a keynote presenter, in fact, at the conference, and to bring my chamber choir. And I thought of, I mean, because just my reaction was sort of like what yours is. I mean, out of, if you ask me to list the top 10 places I would think that we might visit as a choral entity or to do any kind of musical interface, it probably wouldn't be India. But I was immediately intrigued because it is a nation with a very rich and old heritage. You know, a great civilization, as you know, the Indus Valley civilization, you know, has its roots there. And by the way, it's just the second most populous nation on the face of the earth.
Yes. So I was worth mentioning.
Worth mentioning. So I was immediately intrigued, and so one thing led to another, and they issued from the university and from the Inter-University Center for Studies in Science and Music, which is a collaborative venture within India, the invitation for me to come and to be a keynoter and for my singers to come and to do a concert.
Hmm. I suppose it's one thing for you to say for yourself, yes, I want to go to India. Yes, I'll come and do this. It's maybe a trickier step to engage your own students who are part of the Voices of Parkside, particularly for a trip which I assume is pretty costly.
And all of those things, yes. And I have to, you know, I can't, you know, give too many accolades to them for a number of things. First off, as I've often said to them in the months since, for buying into that idea, you know, because at first it was an idea. And you know that you can do choral tours that XYZ tour company has prepackaged, and you know, five wonderful days and nights in Barcelona and so forth, or
Austria, or wherever.
You know.
Yeah.
And you know, all of the one, and they're wonderful places to go. But this didn't start out like that. It was very conceptual in its beginning, and so it was a thing of trying to sell to them the concept. There were some students who immediately thought, "Yeah, that's interesting." There were some students who thought, "Like, what?"
Right.
And so. What happened over a course of a relatively few weeks, because this starts out in the spring of this year, I have students who begin to buy into that and to make that happen. And, in fact, and I'm very proud, extremely proud to say this, who generate on an individual level most of the cost of the trip. We had one anonymous donor who's very kind, who went to our foundation and donated some funds, which helped in some very important aspects of this trip. But for the most part, these are students who in some cases worked jobs who weren't working, worked extra jobs, worked extra hours and all of those things to make it happen, because they became believers and they wanted to do this this wonderful thing and have this life-changing, life-lifting experience.
Wow. I'm impressed because, of course, the other matter, too, is not only do we not necessarily think of India as this center of choral music activity, but I think also for the typical young person, or maybe the typical person of any age, it's also not necessarily a place we immediately gravitate towards as a tourist attraction, although there's an incredible amount of things to see, but we also tend to think of India as kind of a crowded, maybe somewhat chaotic country, and maybe with fewer comforts of home than you might find in other places. And I'm always impressed when young people are willing to, in a sense, step over any of those kind of mental barriers and get excited about the idea of taking themselves to a place like India.
Yeah, and that's something else that I give them accolades for. You know, and what you said is true, and it's probably sort of the coin which, you know, has the two sides, as all coins do, that because we didn't embrace it initially as a kind of tourist thing, and this is a tourist destination or whatever, that helped to create, I think, some expectations on the parts of the students that what we're going to do is going to make an effort to connect with this country or this part of the country, because we went to the state of Kerala, which is on the southwest tip of the subcontinent of India. But it helped them to think of embracing this in a real way and not sort of going for all of the glitzy and glamorous things that might be there. So, and our hosts more generally, it's the Inner University Center, it's Mahatma Gandhi University, but specifically a very wonderful colleague whom I had the pleasure, finally, when I got there, meeting in person, I felt like I'd known him for years, Dr. Robinette Jacob, who is the director of tourism studies there at the university, and his wonderful wife, Asha, who is a doctor. They both did a yeoman's job in helping to prepare for us and then host us once we got there. They had this terrific program of activities that really connected with the history and the culture of the area. Yeah, so it wasn't just sort of, you know, all glitz. Mm-hmm. So, for example, they made sure that we went to see some of the older churches there. We went to an old mosque. We went to an old synagogue there, and were really surprised at all of the history. For example, I would not have had any idea that there'd be a synagogue in India.
Right.
But there was. I mean, as a result of that larger diaspora that happened for the Jewish people, I would have associated Christianity with, say, the British who established the East India Company or something like that. But St. Thomas, the apostle, went there and so planted that seed 2,000 years ago, literally.
Wow.
So, all of those kinds of things. They took us into what they call the backwaters, which are the canals in that area. It's a lot of canals. Very nice scenery. But it wasn't just to see the pretty scenery. It was to have stops along the way where we'd get out and we'd visit some of the local people who were artisans and who were involved in some way in producing things that were used to help float tourism. And in exchange, a lot of the tourist dollars didn't just kind of flow through and out. A lot of those dollars went to went to the local people, which was just, I think, a really smart way of doing things. But responsible tourism is something that we engaged and connected with directly. We ate every meal we ate, quote-unquote, Indian food. Now, obviously, that covers a lot of territory because there are a lot of different takes to the cuisine. But, we didn't do, McDonald's or KFC or whatever. Even though those are there. We ate the local food. Wow. So it was great to make a real effort to connect with the culture and to respect the country that we were going to beyond just, oh, this is a sexy place to be.
Right, or a very pretty place.
Yeah.
I think the phrase is sometimes you traveled close to the ground as opposed to, within an insulated air-conditioned bus looking out through windows with a kind of a sense of distance from the people in the place.
Yeah, we did.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. James Kinchin from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, the director of choral activities there. He is just back from a trip to India with his Voices of Parkside, where they presented 2 formal and 3 informal concerts and experienced much of that fascinating and complex country. Dr. Kinchin, it seems sort of crazy, if you don't mind me speaking frankly, to take a choral trip on the 19th of September. I just can't imagine how this all got put together in such a short amount of time. I mean, so close to the beginning of the school year. How did you manage that?
Well, I mean, it was a lot of work. And as I said, it was not a prepackaged travel experience. So we had to put a lot of pieces together. I won't bore you with all of the trips that I made down to Chicago to get visas processed and all of that. But of course, obviously, we had to go when the conference was, and the conference was scheduled for when it was scheduled.
Right.
And we had to make the decision to embrace that. And so what that meant for us, particularly in terms of the choral piece of things, before India, everything seemed to point to India. That was the big push. And then we went on September 19th, we flew out of O'Hare on Emirates Airways, and we connected in Dubai and went from there to Cochin, which is the international airport in India that we flew into. So everything was sort of leading up to that, and that was the big push to do that. And then afterwards, it's almost like, okay, so the semester's starting,
yeah,
and then there's a lot
this.
Of push, catch up. But you know, with no regrets. I mean, we embraced the opportunity.
Sounds like you made it work somehow.
Yeah, we made it work.
So when did the music get prepared? Did you begin back in the spring?
Well, no. Actually, we began in the summer. Yeah, and you know, as a musician and one who does choral leadership as well, that we're always sort of projecting, you know, okay, so here's what we need to do, here's when we need to do it. And so moving back, working back, what's the preparation that's necessary to get us to the destination?
Right.
And many times we've learned through painful experience that we should be a little bit more liberal in planning those things than conservative, because sometimes things happen and the best laid plans, and you know that old cliched quote. But I was, I think, pretty conservative. And so what I did is I established three extended rehearsals in the summer. And I did that in lieu of doing some regular thing, because people have vacations and people have other plans, and it would be tough.
And jobs.
And jobs.
And some of them have more jobs than normal right now because of this trip.
Because they're trying to raise the money. So, yeah. So I did three of those extended rehearsals. And I think we had what I would consider to have been a decent program in terms of the rigor and the substance of it. You know, we attempted to do sort of a variety of things. We began the program with motets by Viadana and by Palestrina, his gorgeous Tu es Petrus. We did a couple of songs by American composers, sacred pieces, the Alleluia of Randall Thompson's, and the lesser known but still wonderful Lord We Give Thanks to Thee by Undine Smith Moore. We did a couple of part songs by Fanny Mendelssohn Hensel.
Mm.
We did also three English part songs, one of them by Charles Hubert Hastings Parry, Music When Soft Voices Die. We did Arthur Sullivan's Echoes.
I love that.
Isn't it a little piece? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Gerald Fenzi's My Spirit Sang All Day. We did a couple of folk pieces, one from Venezuela, from that area, called Duerme Negrito. We also did a tango. We sang a tango, one of the Piazzolla tangos, called, and it escapes me, I'll come back to that. But we also attempted to make a nod toward India by doing a couple of settings. These are from John Alden Carpenter's Gitanjali, his set of a cycle of songs. These are soprano alto adaptations, SSA adaptations of solo songs he did. When I Bring to You Colored Toys, which was done for SSA by a woman named Althea Turner, that probably back in the 20s. And then I did a companion setting for that, The Sleep That Flits on Baby's Eyes. And then we did a setting of a Gandhi quote that this is not something that I boast about, but I was moved by it to the point that I set it to music.
Mm.
And it's called The Way of Truth and Love Have Always Won. It just struck me when I was looking through Gandhi quotes, and it goes something like this: when I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love have always won.
Oh.
There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time, they may seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall, always.
Yeah. Wow.
And then we concluded the program with four spiritual settings. I Want to Be Ready by James Miller, John Wesley Works, Rockin' Jerusalem, Steal Away, a gorgeous setting by Roland Cotter, and finally William Dawson's Ain't It That Good News.
Mm-hmm. You told us that you performed two formal concerts and three informal concerts. Mm-hmm. I'm curious about where you sang your formal concerts, but I'm also curious about the circumstances under which these informal performances took place.
Yeah. Well, you know, the formal ones, obviously, we sang for at a big session for the conference, and we did the whole nine yards there. We also sang at Rajagiri College. That was a formal performance. That's in Cochin, about 2 hours away from where we were most of the time, which was Katayam. And then informally, we sang at the Saruti Music School and Seminary. That was sort of like, okay, well, you sang something? So, yes, we did. We sang also informally at the CMS College. We really had gone there to hear their students perform, and we were real pleased to have them perform for us. I said, well, okay, you all sing something. So we sang. And then we were at one of the old churches, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the name of it. And it's not a terribly large church, but it was an old church, and we were very struck by the history of it. And so one of the students said, "Can we sing?" I said, "Well, yes, let's sing." You know, so we did something for the people there.
So what would you say was kind of the reception afforded you by the people who heard you sing? And are we talking about people who are accustomed to hearing the sort of music that you performed, or to these kind of occasions?
Yeah. Oh, those are perfect questions. The reception was warm and very, very receiving and welcoming to what we were presenting. People really liked what we were doing. And yes, you're absolutely right. It's not what they're accustomed to hearing. Hmm. You know, for the most of the people in the area where we went, the term classical music, you know, in quotes, it connotes something totally different from what we do. You know, theirs is sort of an Eastern classical music, an Indian music based on ragas or scale pattern, sort of, is a simple way of describing that. And it's traditional, and it's something that they learn across classes, across generations, and it's just simply amazing to hear. But what we had to offer was very, very different from what they hear. And in fact, for many of them, hearing our program was the first time hearing what we would call Western choral music.
Wow.
But they were really very receptive. At the end of the conference performance, we received a standing ovation. We received one at Rajagiri College as well, which was very gratifying. You know, performers like to be liked.
Of course. Yeah. Well, and to make a difference and have an impact, that's the best feeling in the world. Yeah. Great. How many singers?
Well, we had a total of 15, 10 of whom were current students, and 5 were alums of that group. And it was a wonderful mix. And I guess, of course, it's easy for me to say, but they did a really wonderful job. One of the things that I was sort of worried about, because, see, most of these people had never been outside of the country at all,
right,
to go anywhere.
Sure.
So I was sort of afraid that we would get there and they would sort of get this kind of deer in the headlight look and just to sort of get frozen in place, you know, different place, different continent, different audience. Oh, my gosh.
Right, just overwhelmed, bewildered. And
they were totally, completely into the music, and we made music on the stage, and that's one of the greatest things that you can experience in life ever.
Sounds like a tremendous experience, but like you said, now you're back, and now it's like post-India, and
post-India.
So now you're getting ready for the next thing. What is the next thing for the choral department there?
My chamber group will engage a performance on November 15th that will also involve singers from Carthage and a couple of other colleges.
Oh, yeah, right.
Where we sing the works of the fabulous young composer Abby Martinez.
Right. That's for first Fine Arts at First,
fine
right?
Fine Arts at First, yep. That's correct. Then in December we do Nguzo Saba Suite, which is Glenn Burley's wonderful 7-movement Kwanzaa piece.
Yep.
We have done that probably at least 9 or 10 times now over the years. He wrote it for us. We commissioned him, and it's just an amazing piece. It's a blast. And it continues to inspire people who sing it as well as people who hear it.
Mm. Well, terrific. Well, we're glad you're back safe and sound from what sounds like an absolutely magnificent trip.
Yes.
And I'm so glad you could stop by to tell us all about it. And wherever your travels take you next, Cuba or India or wherever, we hope all these experiences continue to be this exciting and meaningful.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your having me, Greg.
Dr. James Kinchin, the Director of Choral Activities at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Tomorrow on the morning show, quite a shift of topic, but it's something I'm excited about. We're going to be talking with the executive producer and creator of a web series. This is a series that appears to be a television series, but you don't see it on television. You only see it on YouTube. It's called Star Trek Continues. It is one of several fan-based series which perpetuate the original Star Trek series. But this is the one everybody says is absolutely the best, and they achieve absolutely extraordinary authenticity. You watch a few seconds of this, and you would swear that you're watching the original series. The appearance of the sets, the feel of it, the integrity of the scripts. The only thing that is a clue that it isn't is that someone else is playing Captain Kirk, and someone else is playing Mr. Spock, and so on. But five of these episodes have been created thus far. They hope to create a total of 13. Tomorrow on the morning show, I'm going to be speaking with the executive director and creator of Star Trek Continues. Vic Monagna is his name. That's tomorrow on the morning show. We remind you that the morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, which is wgtd.org. Click on Talk. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. From WGTD's community calendar, it's time for the second high-definition simulcast from the Metropolitan Opera in New York City. Coming up this Saturday at 12 noon, Giuseppe Verdi's masterpiece, Othello, his magnificent setting of Shakespeare's Othello, with an all-star cast in a brand-new Bartlett Shear production. This live performance will be beamed to movie theaters across the country, including Tinseltown in Kenosha and the Renaissance Theater in Sturtevant. Again, it begins at 12 noon. If you would like more information about this high-definition simulcast or any of the others which are coming up in this 10th anniversary season, you're invited to go to the Metropolitan Opera's website. And that website address is metopera.org. Again, M-E-T-O-P-E-R-A, metopera.org. Now a look at our weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois on this cloudy and drizzly Thursday. Our forecast does call for some lingering sprinkles this morning, but then we should have a partly sunny day and windy conditions, a high today of 66 degrees. It will be clear tonight and cold as we drop to a low of 38 degrees, sunny tomorrow, and a high of just 50 degrees. Saturday will be sunny and even cooler, and some widespread frost expected Saturday morning. Saturday's high, just 48 degrees. Sunny again with a bit of frost in the morning. We'll warm to 55 degrees, and by Monday we should have rebounded into the mid-60s for a daytime high. We should see that for most of the rest of this week, of this next coming week, with the chance of rain resuming. This is WGTDHD.